welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast. Happy New Year. Not technically our first show of the new year, but it's my first show of the new year because my co-host, Nate Mavis. Hi, Nate.
Hey, how's it going? Welcome back to the USA, Andrew.
Yeah, because Nate and Gareth Chandler took over last episode, and I thought you guys did a really fantastic job. I learned a few things from the strategy discussion, and I enjoyed that a lot. I hope our listeners did as well.
Yeah, definitely. We enjoyed it. You know, we missed you, but Gareth's a good guy to talk to. And I have read that he's arrived safely in wherever he's going to next. Ecuador? No. Anyway, he's arrived safely in some country or the other, which means that he has escaped the potential trouble with Fernando. And all's well, I think.
That's right. I forgot about the Fernando thing. That was awesome.
Yeah, it's... Like, you would think, like, from a different person, you might think that he was just making up the story or trying to be exciting, but I have no doubt that all that's 100% true from Gareth, so.
Plants about the episode is that you didn't follow up to get the full Fernando story.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed pretty straightforward, and if you read the Borderline Gambling series of articles, I mean, Gareth is traveling for a lot of reasons, but South American women is definitely one of them. So not really that surprising, I guess, all things considered.
Did you do anything fun for New Year's?
No, I never do. I always just hang out. I read a book about Rails development. I'm trying to learn about computers, and that's all I did. Hung out with the cat. Yeah, did you?
I went to see Louis C.K., who is one of my favorites. I mean, I really like good stand-up comedy, and I really like smart stand-up comedy, and I think Louis is both of those things. So that was pretty cool for me. And I mentioned on a previous episode that I had a friend from Budapest who was visiting with me for a couple days. So I wasn't really sure. Basically, like I'd bought these tickets quite some time ago, or my girlfriend did actually, quite some time ago. And then, you know, it turned out Miklos was going to be staying with me. And I mean, he speaks English pretty well, but I was sort of like, well, you know, we're going to go to this thing, and hopefully you'll get something out of it. The one interesting thing is that Louis C.K. is actually, I mean, his last name, C.K., is Hungarian. He's not from Hungary, per se. Like, I don't know if he's ever even been there.
He's from Mexico, right?
He was born in Mexico, yeah. But I believe his at least one of his parents was a Hungarian Jew who moved to Mexico, or fled to Mexico, maybe. So yeah, he is of Hungarian ancestry, which Miklos found interesting. But I think I don't think he had ever even knew that much about stand-up comedy, or I don't know how much of a thing that is in Hungary. So, but I think he enjoyed it a lot. It was really an excellent show. I mean, I've seen just about everything that is readily available of Louis C.K.'s. I mean, anything by him that's on YouTube or on his website or anything like that, I've seen. And this, I think, was right up there among the very best of his material. I thought it was a pretty awesome.
Yeah. Show. Yeah. Fantastic. I'm definitely a fan, and I'm like you, I've watched pretty much everything I can get my hands on. So
now is going to turn into a special at some point. So if you don't get a chance to see him live, at least see the special. But, I will say actually seeing him live was interesting because, one of his great qualities as a comedian, I think, is being able to make people squirm, make people uncomfortable.
Yes.
He closes the show with a couple of jokes on topics that are nearly as far out there as you could get in terms of things that would be usually be considered off limits for a comedian to tell a joke about.
Yeah.
And he sets it up, you know, knowing that, saying like, okay, and now a joke about X. You know. But like actually being in the room and hearing like just kind of feeling so many people like just feeling the discomfort in the room was a significant part of the experience, I think.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. You actually got to be there for the classic stand-up experience of being taken way out of your comfort zone along with the rest of a room full of people.
Exactly, yeah. And so I think Miklos enjoyed it as well. He said that he did. He said he understood about 90% of what was going on, which is good. And then he and I went to the PCA a few days after that, which I actually have a hand to discuss, not from the tournament itself, which my table was extremely bad, pretty boring in terms of the actual poker that I played. I mean, I had some interesting conversations, but it was a very tough table, and I was pretty card dead most of the day, and then went out on a bad beat. So not really a lot to discuss from the tournament, but I did play some interesting cash game hands that I thought would be good to talk about.
Your blog posts were pretty interesting about taking trips to see people hustle rich tourists and all that. So yeah, I mean the PCA was one of my favorite times in my poker career, really. I just love how international it is and how much fun it is and how people are going there basically to have a good time for the most part. So
The international aspect, definitely. I mean, I mentioned on Twitter, at least, and maybe on my blog as well, that I met a listener, the podcast from Germany. I actually he called me on this. I guess I slightly misunderstood what he was telling me. He wasn't actually listening to the podcast at the exact moment that he encountered me. I think his English was very good, but he was a non-native English speaker, and I think he said, "I recognize your voice because I am listening to your podcast," and I
okay.
thought he meant he was literally listening to it at that second, but I think he just meant generally he was a listener to the podcast. So he saw my blog post and corrected me on that point.
Yeah, the progressive present really varies a lot from language to language. It's causes issues.
The Estonian police officer one night, it was and then of course even though I'm not on Team Online anymore, I still have some ins with them, and they're from all around the world. So yeah, it's definitely a cool opportunity to meet poker fans from all over.
Talon Chick said that somebody knew who she was because she was on the podcast. That made me proud.
And we should say actually that both Talon Chick and the other lady that we've had on the show, Vanessa Selbst, had a lot of success at the PCA. Adrian won the triple stud event, and then Vanessa very impressively won the 25K high roller. So a nice showing for them. Very glad to see our former guests going on to do well.
Yeah, and officially that is not podcast effect because it didn't happen at the Bellagio, but still, it's good to see. And if you want to see some very interesting hands, you should check out the replay on PokerStars.tv of Vanessa's run through that final table. I mean, some of it is just her flopping sets a lot, but she also plays a lot of hands in a very creative and intelligent way, as you would expect. And it's well worth watching.
I didn't know about that. That does sound good.
Yeah, it's good. And it's cards up technically, although there were some technical problems. So a lot of hands, you only see one card from some people. But most of the time, by the turn or so, you know everybody's cards. And it's just very, very interesting. And they're pretty good about telling you what the stack sizes are and what the payout structure is and everything. So it's very instructive. It's probably one of the seven most instructive televised or web streamed poker things I've ever seen. And that's saying something. I watch a lot of this stuff.
I'd be interested in seeing the whole list of the top seven sometime.
It's not really determinate yet. That's just an estimate. I think number one would have to be there's about 8 hours of coverage from the 50K Players Championship in 2011. And there are a lot of interesting hands that come up there. So it's Scott Siver, Brian Rast, Oeyes Ahmed, Min Lai, Phil Hellmuth, Matt Glantz, maybe somebody else. And a lot of interesting things happen. And you can go back after the fact and check out the ESPN coverage, like the episodic coverage, to see what the hands were. But I learned a lot. That's something I've watched twice. Like I'd seen it before, then before I went out to Las Vegas last year, I watched all 8 hours again just to study it a little bit more carefully because I thought the hands were very instructive. So,
Yeah, I guess so.
yeah.
Well, shall we make our own small contribution to the world cache of poker strategy material?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, by the way, that's top seven, not counting the 15 episodes of the podcast. So it's one of the 22 most interesting and informative poker things ever made. So you've got a hand from the PCA, is that right?
Yeah, I do. And actually, I want to talk to you a little bit about this table even before we get to the hand itself, because it was an interesting circumstance. There were some pretty good high stakes games, or relatively high stakes games, going at the PCA. And this one night, I don't remember which night of the week it was. The days kind of blur together while you're there. But there was one night where I'd been playing in a couple of five, or I'd been playing in a 5-10 game. There were a few other 5-10 games going. I'd been on a waiting list for 10-25 game for quite some time. And at some point, one of the other 5-10 games that just all the players decided to turn it into a 10-25 game, which I guess the floor didn't know about. So there was an open seat there that hadn't been called because they didn't realize it was a 10-25 game. So I just kind of had to figure out for my own that game was going on and get over into it. But once I did, the game was quite good because there were two players, and I later moved to have them directly on my right for a while. Initially, they were on my left. There were two players who had both been drinking a good bit, and at first I thought that they were both like just drinking a lot and playing badly. It later, I think it was actually the case that one of them was clearly very drunk. The other one, I think, was like drinking some and like kind of trying to have a good time, but was mostly egging on the other one to, I mean, they weren't, I don't think they knew each other before they sat down. I think he kind of saw it as a good opportunity, and so it was like sort of kind of going along, but playing up the extent to which he was going along in order to like keep the other guy drinking and having a good time and staying at the table.
Okay.
I kind of got the impression that that was what was going on.
Yeah. Also, can I just say you have some higher order evidence in this case also, because if people want to bump a game up, it's usually for one of two reasons. Reason one, that card room usually doesn't get a game at the higher limit, and they just want to play that higher limit no matter what, and that's not the case at the PCA. And reason two is there is some specific reason, usually a person or a set of persons, who they want to play bigger against. Or reason three, they're stuck. All that is good for you. So you should also just be happy to be sitting at that bumped up game.
I think at least reason two was clearly in effect, and quite possibly reason three as well for some folks. So like our half of the table, and I was I never drink when I'm playing, so I was not drinking with them, but I was also, we've discussed this on the show as well, my resolution to have more fun at the table. So I was like doing my best to have a good time, both for its own sake and also to keep the drunk guy having a good time staying at the table. So I'm kind of playing around with all this. And then the other side of the table, like the three of us are all next to each other. Then the other side of the table, there's a couple of like young guys who are, this guy got the headphones on and they're watching something or playing something on their iPad and not really engaging with the table at all. And I guess I really am starting to turn into a live nit, but it like that crystallized for me more than anything else what people Daniel Negreanu were complaining about when they say, well, headphones should be banned and hoodies should be banned. I mean, I know part of it is that Daniel feels like being able to get physical tells and table talk tells and that kind of thing from people is part of his game. But I also do think it's just really bad for the game when there's people like that who, essentially their attitude is like, could you stop being so annoying and just like give me your money? I just want to like sit here and take your money and not like interact with you in any way, not contribute to your experience in any way. I just want you to like throw money at me.
Yes.
Very frustrating.
I mean, also, there are some basic security issues with letting people use electronics at the table.
Yeah, I kind of go back and forth on that. Like obviously when you're playing online, but you're on a computer, but something still makes me uncomfortable about people being on a computer at a live poker table.
Yeah, this is something I actually got into a discussion about on Twitter yesterday. So there's just this basic fact that games are less friendly and less gregarious than they were 7 years ago. And there are a lot of explanations for that. And I think one of them gets overlooked. And my conjecture was that one's propensity to chat at a table is inversely proportional, or inversely correlated at least, to one's skill. So it might just be an unfortunate fact that because the games have gotten tougher, we should just expect them to get a little bit less friendly. And it's not an absolute rule. There are all sorts of great players who are really friendly to be around at the table, but just generally, the better somebody is, the less likely he is to want to chat at the table. And maybe we shouldn't overlook that as an explanation of why the games are quieter than they used to be.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. Although I also think the curve may start to bend up again at the very highest level.
I know I talk less than I used to just because I think it's really, really valuable for me to get as much information as I can. And I tend to lose focus on other things that are going on at the table if I'm having a conversation or something like that. So, I mean, I definitely try to be very friendly and casual even, but at some point there's just a trade-off between getting into details about whatever you're talking about and paying attention to the hand that's going on between two people at the other end of the table. And especially if I'm playing a $10,000 tournament, and even more so if I'm playing a $10,000 tournament partly with other people's money. I don't think it's responsible for me to neglect what's going on.
So I'm kind of curious in this circumstance, is there ever a point where you consider it unethical to be playing with somebody who's inebriated or otherwise under the influence to the point where they're just not, I mean, beyond not playing well, like almost like losing track of the action, or is there ever a point where you would consider it like unethical to be playing with someone?
Yeah, it's tough. It's something I've never quite worked out for myself. I mean, I wouldn't play poker if I didn't think it was permissible to win money from gambling addicts, for example. If you don't think, if you aren't comfortable with the idea of some chunk of your winnings at poker coming from addictive gamblers, drunks, people making big mistakes, then you just shouldn't be playing poker. Or you should only be playing in home games where you know every single person very well. So I guess I have that background belief that it's morally permissible for me to do that. Although if I could somehow magically choose to not play against gambling addicts, then I think I would do that. In terms of people who are blackout drunk, I would prefer not to be playing with them. Like if it were up to me, I would be very happy to eject them from the casino for the night, or, you know, get them out of the game. And I would want them out of the game. Whether it's impermissible to play against them is a trickier thing. I think it would be unethical to like egg them on and to try to keep them drinking a lot when you know that they're sort of past drunk and really super blacked out and really in a bad way. I think that would be impermissible. I'm not sure it's impermissible to keep playing with them for a few reasons, but I'm not 100% confident in that. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you correctly guessed where I was going with this, which is that I do think there's, I think it's a difficult thing to spell out, or I haven't thought enough about it anyway to spell out like exactly what I would consider morally permissible versus not morally permissible. But I do think one important distinction is the difference is kind of the passive versus active role that you're playing. I mean, whether the person is remaining at the table of their own volition versus whether you're doing things to encourage them to stay at the table, or that maybe even a level beyond that is whether you're doing things to encourage them to continue drinking or to continue to enter a state where they're making less and less good decisions. So I mean, I guess I'm thinking that there's lines in each of those places, and I guess I caught myself doing some things. I certainly wasn't encouraging the guy to like continue drinking, but I was trying to do things to keep the game entertaining for him, and knowing that I was doing it for that purpose, like not just for myself to have more fun. But one good example of this, one of the like nitty younger guys who was on his iPad the whole time, he was in a big pot with the drunk guy that he ended up losing, although I don't think that was the source of his being upset, although it probably didn't help. But the game is going very slowly at this point as a result mostly of this one drunk guy who just like really doesn't know what's going on, keeps trying to put money in the pot, like it's trying to straddle from every position and trying to call before the action's on him, and sometimes trying to show his cards to the person next to him before that person has folded, just all everything that a person could possibly do to slow down the game, this guy is doing. So any hand is taking, no exaggeration, like 5 or 6 minutes, because there's a few other people at the table who have been drinking also and are kind of like, they're not nearly as disruptive as this guy, but they're all trying to be funny and like throwing out these like the same jokes over and over again, and just sort of generally slowing things down and like asking, even though they know it's on them, they'll be like, oh, is it on me? Like, and just, wasting 30 seconds with dumb crap like that. So that everything's going really slowly. And then, of course, the drunk guy has his chips like stacked very haphazardly. Some of them have fallen into his drink cup. So you can't tell basic things like exactly how much he has behind. And the dealers are not doing a great job of managing the game. They're, I think, feeling a little overwhelmed, which is kind of understandable. But so this one of the young guys gets involved in a plot that ends up becoming a very big plot, and he's having trouble figuring out exactly how much the drunk guy has behind. And I had mentioned already being kind of frustrated with this kid and a few others like him, who I didn't feel were really contributing anything to the game or even doing their part to make an entertaining game for the people who are losing money. And he's getting very frustrated about this. And then after the hand, he's kind of like yelling about the guy and how long the guy is taking and all this sort of stuff. And I'm kind of trying to tell him without coming right out and saying like, "Hey, this guy's losing a lot of money, calm down and be nice to him." I'm basically trying to communicate that to him, and I'm saying like, "Are you really getting upset about this?" Like, and the kid's like, "It's just taking forever. It's so slow." And I'm saying to him, "You understand what I'm saying, right? Like, just let it go. Don't, this is just how this game is going to be. And if you want to play in this game where there's a guy who's pitching thousands of dollars, you're going to have to put up with some frustration." I couldn't quite say that, but I think he understood that that's what I was saying. So I don't know, like, whether that, I started to wonder whether that crossed the line a little bit into, my motivation for doing this was so that the drunk guy wouldn't get annoyed and leave the game, which I guess you're saying you'd rather he would leave the game.
I think so. I mean, it depends on a lot of things, and I'm not 100% comfortable like pronouncing on these issues. But yeah, I think that's probably a game that for a lot of reasons I might not want to be in, not least because when it's going that slowly, like even if you have a big loser in the game, your win rate might actually not be what you think it is. Like if you were to just go get a good night's sleep and then play in a 10-25 game the next day with like four guys who are sort of crappy grinders, your dollars per hour win rate might well be higher, you know? And especially if you're annoyed by the guys on the iPad, and if you're waiting 6 or 7 minutes between hands, and if you're not entirely comfortable with the dynamic at the table for ethical reasons, I think that's a really good time to make a quit.
Fair point.
I think I probably would have said something to the guy just because fish abuse is not a nice thing to do, and I don't know, especially since it's not in his interest, it's not in the abuser's interest or in the abusee's interest, and you know, it's a good time to say something along the lines of shut the hell up for a lot of reasons. If you were doing it just to keep the blackout drunk guy in the game, then I think you start to get into some dicier territory. Although again, I'm not 100% sure where I stand on all these things.
I mean, I definitely wouldn't say that was the only motivation, but you can look at it as a little like, the kind of what's going on is I'm saying to this kid like, "Hey, let's work together to keep this guy in the game so that we can take his money," which is kind of always what you're doing in a poker game anyway. I mean, you're always obviously trying to take money from people, and if they're less good than you don't want them to leave the game. So I guess it's mostly just a question of how much the introduction of alcohol changes any of that.
Yeah, I think it's tough. I think it also depends a lot on like this person's patterns of drinking and to what extent he could have reasonably foreseen that he was going to get blackout drunk and whether he has a pattern of getting blackout drunk and playing poker and things like that. And if he knew how strong the drinks were and all that. Like, I just think there are a lot of variables in the situation. I really do get surprised at how reflexively some people are sticklers for the rules. I've seen people complain at 2-5 games when obvious known donators came, sat down with like two racks of chips and tried to buy in for like $670. And they're like, "Oh, no, the max buy here is $500. We can't let him buy in for $670." It's like, so first you're alienating him and you're just being a huge nit. And second, that's 170 more dollars that's going away from him in all likelihood. Like, do you really just want to make a big stink about that? Are you sure that's what you want to be doing?
Yeah, it's like people are really putting no thought into the reason for the rules and just like insisting on enforcing them on principle. Well, anyway, thanks for your input on that. I just thought it was an interesting situation that maybe some of our listeners will have some input to it as well. But it was something that picked at me a little bit the next day.
Yeah, I mean it's polite of you to thank me for a non-answer, but mostly I guess my 2 points are that I think it's generally okay to play poker knowing that some of your money is going to come from people with problems, and second, that despite that, there are some individual cases where at least I would prefer not to be in that game. But I don't know. Maybe we should talk about a hand now, huh?
That actually, I mean, this is a hand that came up in that game, and I think knowing a bit about those dynamics is not trivial for the purpose of analyzing this hand. And I'll tell you, the people who end up being the two main villains in this hand, one of them is the guy who was sitting immediately to the left of the drunk player, the one who I was saying at first I thought was just a drunk himself, and then I realized he was an amateur player who was a pretty successful amateur player, and I do think he was, like, even more than I was, kind of baiting the drunk guy, or, like, trying to make sure that he stayed in the game and losing money and whatnot. So I mean, he was savvy in that way, but in terms of the way he played, it was very, I would consider it amateurish, at least for a 10-25 game. Like, often his bet sizing gave away a lot about what he had and what he was planning on doing. He just kind of played in a very, like, straightforward way. So he was the kind of person who I'm sure could make money in a game, like, when there is just a big drunk donator, where just, like, playing in a very straightforward way will enable you to win money. But I don't think he was really, at least he wasn't exhibiting anything in that game that struck me as being, like, much beyond level one poker. So that's one significant player in this hand. The other is another one of the young guys. I'm inclined to call him, I mean, maybe like a life nit, because he was the one of the ones, like, with the headphones and the iPad and getting frustrated about the pace of the game, and sort of refusing to actually. At one point, the drunk guy wanted to institute a rule where if you won the pot without showdown, you had to show one of your cards at random. And this guy was initially, like, refusing to participate in that. He did eventually agree, but there was, like, that sort of thing that it seemed to me, like, obvious that you should agree to do that. So he's the other guy. And I think, aside from being a bit of a life nit, he was actually quite good at poker from what I saw. Like, I'm pretty sure there were a few spots where he bluff raised in multi-way pots when this the amateurish guy with the bet sizing tails, like, he would give away some indication that he was weak, and then this player would raise him. Just he was really fighting for pots and thinking on a pretty high level about what was going on. I was definitely impressed by his play, although not his demeanor. So those are the two most important villains in this hand. It's a 10-25 game, as I mentioned, and it's a game that allows button straddles. So I'm straddling for $50 on the button in this to start this hand. The other young guy on the iPad is in early position. Now, this is the one who was complaining about the drunk guy and the one that I had a talk with. He opens for $150 in early position, which is a little on the small side. I think it's, if anything, an indication of weakness because, he could raise more. The drunk was calling almost anything. So, and it's with me straddling, it's only like three times the straddle. So I think the drunk probably would have been willing to call a larger raise, and the fact that this guy chose not to make a larger raise is probably telling. He opens for $150. The drunk guy calls, the amateurish guy calls, and it's $100 more to me on the button. I'm holding 9-3 of hearts. I decided to call there, although this isn't the most interesting part of the hand. But I mean, quickly, do you think that's an okay call, or would you fold?
Yeah, I would.
I probably covered everyone else, but not by a lot. Like, I mean, pretty much everyone had over 5K.
Two more blinds or two more effective blinds is in with position, especially if you are going to bluff raise the amateurish guy sometimes and know where the drunk guy's at and you have a good idea about the under the gun player's range. Like I think you can't go wrong playing a suited hand for two more blinds in that spot. But maybe if you turned even maybe even one of those factors being not as favorable as it is might turn it into a fold. So like if the amateurish player wasn't so prone to giving away a lot of information, or if you or if the donator weren't playing as badly, or if you had some reason to believe that the under the gun player was strong, then I like a fold. But this combination of factors, I think it's worth $100 to call.
Okay, good. So I called. So five of us go to the flop, the big blind called as well, and the big blind is the guy who I described as a shark, the one I was saying I really respected his play. So five of us go to the flop. That's I guess $760 in the pot if the small blind folded. So $760 in the pot. I'm holding 9-3 of hearts, and the flop is Jack 7-4 with two hearts. I believe the Jack and the four were the hearts, but I'm not 100% on that. I don't think it matters terribly much. So Jack 7-4 with two hearts. I have 9-3 of hearts. It checks around to the amateurish guy who bets $300 into the $760 pot.
Raise. I think you should raise. And I think that because that bet likely communicates weakness and you have a flush draw and you can barrel him later, I think calling, planning to raise him later might also be acceptable if you think that the drunk guy is going to stick around and then pay off when you make a flush. Actually, calling. Planning on getting tricky later is probably better if you think you can keep other people who are going to pay you a lot with a flush in the pot. But I think 300 into 70, 750, you should plan on winning that pot some way or the other.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And this may actually have been my largest mistake in the hand, not raising now. The only thing I'll say is I didn't really interpret the amateurish guy's bet as weak, because I don't think he was thinking as much about the pot size as he should have been. I think that's probably one of those cases where he thought $300 was a stronger bet than it was, and he was betting into four people. And I mean, I don't really have a specific like physical tell on why he thought he was strong, but he did seem to think he was strong. That's just kind of the impression I.
That's different. Yeah, so I put him on something like a queen jack type of hand or like a pocket nines kind of hand that is just asking to get blown out of the water. But if that's what you think, then everything changes. And again, calling has the benefit of keeping other people in the pot who you might want to keep in the pot.
Yeah, I mean, the catch is whether I'm also, if there's a risk of keeping better flush draws in the pot. Right, I've only got a nine high flush draw. There's three other people besides the amateurish guy and me who haven't yet put money in the pot. Do you see any merit in raising to like clean up those hard outs?
Ordinarily, I would, but if there's a guy in the pot who is going to pay you off for a lot of money with, if he has 8-6, he might peel one off with his three straight, and then if he hits an eight, he might call a pot size bet on the turn. I think that's just too much to give up. So ordinarily, I like the idea of raising for precisely that reason, but in this situation, your strategy should be dictated around extracting the most, well, most from the drunk guy in the middle, and also figuring out exactly what the amateurish guy has.
So I just called here, and then the very good player called on the big blind, which I was not too happy about. I just generally I would have liked to have him out of the pot, but I also think that a call from him indicates a draw very frequently. I don't really know. I don't think there's too much else he would be calling with here. Possibly like a queen jack sort of hand could still be ahead. I doubt he's calling with pocket tens or worse.
What about Ace Jack or a hand like that?
Yeah, I guess I would put that in the same category as Queen Jack, like a one pair sort of hand that isn't quite good enough to raise for value. Although I think Ace Jack could potentially raise for value, but I wouldn't want to raise Ace Jack here. So yeah, I think either he'll occasionally have like a one pair kind of hand, but I think it has to be a pretty good one pair. I don't think he's calling with Ace Seven. I don't think he's calling with tens. So it would pretty much have to be a Jack. I can't imagine he didn't squeeze with Queens, Kings, Aces pre. So I think he'd pretty much have to have either top pair or a draw of some sort to call here.
I don't think this is a good spot for him to peel with a gut shot.
It's probably not the worst spot in the world, but it's not great. I mean, if the drunk were already in the pot, it would be better. Maybe he was anticipating that the drunk would call. I guess that could justify feeling with a gut shot. Even then, he's drawing, although obviously it wouldn't be to as good of a draw as I had in that case. But yeah, so he called, and then the original raiser and the drunk both folded. So now we've got 1650 in the pot, and the turn is the deuce of hearts. So I make my flush on the turn. The good player checks in the big blind. The amateur guy bets 600 into 1650. What do you want to do now? I think this is one of the trickier points in the hand.
This is tough. So my first instinct is to call because you are unlikely to get action from much worse if you raise, because your hand would look like, perhaps among other things, what it is. One downside of calling is that you invite a bluff raise or an uncomfortable raise from the player on your left, and you have to fear either folding the best hand or paying off a better hand a significant amount of the time. And normally I wouldn't worry about that too much, but if you really think he's a good player, then that starts to be a bummer. So I also, boy, I mean, also there's some chance that the guy on your right has the nuts or a better flush. So I think all things considered, especially because you'll have a relatively hard time representing too many other hands that aren't flushes, I think ultimately I like just a call.
The one thing you didn't mention that was also going through my head is that I think that the big blind could easily have a better. I guess you did mention that, but I mean, I'm not too thrilled about putting money into the pot while he's sitting behind me because I do feel like he could easily have a better hand as well. Not only could he bluff raise me, but I think that he could possibly have, I would rather have 600 in the pot instead of, 1400 or whatever I would raise to if he ends up waking up behind me with a better flush. Do you think there's any possibility of making him fold a better flush?
Although I'm not sure on the balance it's worth it. Hey, this is a good day for me giving non-answers. I do think that if you raise here, like, zoom to him with Queen 10 of Hearts, that, I mean, it sucks to be him. And so I think that, yeah. Oh, sorry.
I think he has 5,400 still in his stack, and I cover him. So with 1650 in the pot, we've still got three and a half big pot size bets that he would have to be uncomfortable with a non-nut flush.
To be uncomfortable with a non-nut flush. And I mean, if you look at it from his perspective, like raise a $600 bet to 2000 or something like that. I mean, what's he gonna do? Cold call or move all in or something? I mean, I'm not saying he's going to fold Queen 10 of Hearts or Queen 5 of Hearts or whatever he might have. Queen 7 of Hearts maybe. But although he might not have gotten to the flop with those, but I do think that he should not be fist pumping at all if it goes bet raised to him. So if you think that he's really that likely to have a draw, I guess yes, but I don't think that's enough of a reason to turn this into a raise. Also, you can always, I mean, you can't always, but if he's going to fold a better flush now, you might be able to turn your hand into a bluff, as crazy as that sounds later. Nah, it's just crazy. Because once he puts money into the pot, he's too likely to have one of the best flushes. And he can probably put you on a weaker flush, like a lot of weaker flushes. So strike that. I think to answer your question, yes, he will sometimes fold a better flush, but that's not likely enough that it should condition what you're doing.
So I did end up raising, which I wasn't too thrilled about, especially because in retrospect, I'm not sure that a raise has to deter a not a complete bluff shove from him, but if he manages to have the ace of hearts with a jack or I don't know, two pair, I guess he would have raised that on the flop though. I mean, I don't know what he could just jam here. I feel like he's not going to jam a hand that has no equity, like a five, six of spades, where he's has like an open-ended on the flop that now is would be drawing dead if he was called. It's hard for me to imagine him jamming that. But at the same time, what I'm thinking is because I've seen him raise this same player when the same player made weak-looking bets, and this player has just made a weak-looking bet. I'm wondering, maybe I'm just leveling myself here, that my raise is not going to look as strong as it might seem because I am raising a guy who's very likely to fold to a raise. And
Yeah.
whether it's enough to just, ship it or something, just thinking of like trying to re-steal from me.
myself into the blinds spot, and if I'm not playing scared money or and all those other things, like if I have the ace of hearts and a napkin in my hand, and if I see it go bet raise, like okay, try to read the button's hand. He called 100 more dollars before the flop, and maybe he showed some signs of having to think about it before he did. And so then he just called on the flop, and now he's raising the turn. Like that range has a lot of six, seven, or no, like maybe not seven, but six, eight, nine, and 10 high flushes in it. And also, putting myself in his shoes, his hand can look a lot like the nuts or a king high flush. And especially if I can see the ace of hearts, so it has semi bluff value and blocker value, I think I might decide it's time to move all in.
I agree with that. The thing is, I think the only way he can have the ace of hearts is if he has exactly ace of hearts and a jack. I guess it's possible, like if he has ace of hearts seven, I mean, I guess that would be a reason to peel the flop if he's got the backdoor nut flush draw and also middle pair. So, I mean, I guess he could have ace of hearts and any paired card on the board. I don't know how likely he is to call with ace seven offsuit pre, but it was 125 more to him to call. Yeah, so I think it's hard for him to have the bare ace. That's part of why I'm skeptical. That's why I'm saying it matters more whether he can just shove with little to no equity versus whether, I agree that this might well be a bluff shove with the bare ace of hearts, but I think it's very hard for him to have that hand. I think what matters, because it's very unlikely, I think, for him to have a bare ace of hearts. There's only a few combinations of that that really make sense for him to get to the turn. So I think less important than whether or not he can shove here if he happens to have the bare ace is whether he can shove here as a bluff with a lot less equity than that. Could he, or not even shove, but could he three bet with a hand that would be drawing dead against my continuing range? Is he sick enough to do that?
And I don't know the answer to that. I guess I should also just mention the fact that we've talked about on the podcast before, which is that a nine high flush against a range with a lot of flushes in it, especially if you tighten it up pre-flop a lot to account for his being out of position and calling a raise, you're sunk if you're up against a range that's in any significant part flushes.
So I mean, I did end up raising to $1,400 here because I wanted this guy out from behind me, and I also thought that the amateurish guy betting was likely to have out, like he betting a set or two pair or something. I wasn't really too concerned about being beaten by the amateurish guy, but I did think that he was pretty likely to have a hand that could call a raise, and also that I didn't necessarily want, or that I would like to charge some more to see the river. I wasn't really trying to make him fold. It was a pretty small raise.
By the way, can I make a prediction here? And to the listeners, I have not heard this hand or any of the future action or the results before. I do want to say that I think a hand like the nuts is a little bit more likely from this guy than you do, especially if you think his flop bet showed more strength than I think it did. He's doubled it on the turn, and I think he might feel obligated to bet the flop with a lot of his ace X of hearts, and for good reason. So I wouldn't be like worried thinking, oh, this guy bet the turn, he must have the nuts. I definitely would not be thinking that. But I think probably a little bit more worried about this guy than you were at the time. So anyway, so it goes 600, you raised to 14, and
Now the very tough player goes into the tank for no exaggeration, 8 minutes. He tanks, and that's not quite as extreme as it sounds because I think I mentioned this game was going very slowly anyway. So I mean, probably somebody would in a different game would have clocked him before now, but I think everyone had just kind of accepted that this was going to be a very slow moving game. So he's in the tank for 8 minutes before people start complaining about how long it's taking him. And after that, he ships it for 5,400. So it's 4,000 more for me to call. I'm getting basically 2 to 1. It's pretty much a pot-sized raise.
I would just fold. I mean, it's a little bit uncomfortable, but one obvious thing you could have been deliberating with is a medium-sized flush, and you do badly against medium-sized flushes once you condition on the pre-flop action. And I think that people are less likely to bluff and semi-bluff after they've been in the tank for a long time. And also, from a game theory perspective, you are, I guess, near the top of your raising to 1400 range, given that you didn't 3-bet preflop and given that you're capable of raising. But I think that, especially given everything you said about how marked with a draw this guy is, given his flop action, that if you just stack up his range against yours, then look at his shipping range over your raise, I think you're in bad shape and you should make the fold expecting to be folding the best hand about 15% of the time.
Yeah, and I had a lot of time to think while he was in the tank about what I was going to do, so I was able to snap fold when it came back around to me. The slightly tilting part about this hand is that I think I told you earlier he had declined a request to play where you had to show one card
Yeah, that
after.
sucks for you now.
I don't know. So he had since agreed. Like we had since instituted that rule. And the card that was chosen randomly, the dealer was choosing the cards. The card that was chosen was the Eight of Hearts.
I think that's actually more of a sign. This is a math question, but I bet that actually makes it more likely that you were losing than what we already knew.
Even occurred to the possibility of him having a worse flush than mine because mine was so low. And then after seeing the eight, I mean, obviously there's still relatively few combos of that, but and he also might be fast playing on the flop some of those. Well, I don't know if he had like 8-6 of hearts on the flop where he's got a gut shot and a flush draw. It's really not the best spot to fast play because he could easily run into like the nut flush draw or a higher draw. So maybe he wouldn't have fast played it on the flop. But in any event, there's relatively few combos, of course, of eight high flushes for him to have compared to combo, given that he might be calling with like quite a few suited hands in that spot. But yeah, just like it almost didn't occur to me that he might have a lower flush than mine. And then when I saw the eight of hearts, I was like, whoa.
Funny. That's funny. I'm probably embarrassing myself by making that math claim. I'm gonna go after we're done recording and figure this out and maybe link something in the show notes. But I actually my first instinct is that seeing the Eight of Hearts is not as bad for you, or not as tilting for you. Well, I mean, nothing's good or bad for you. You fold it. I mean, you're done. But if we're thinking about the probability that you were actually winning, I'm actually not sure that that probability goes down much or at all once you condition on the fact that what you saw was the Eight of Hearts.
So yeah, that was a pretty unpleasant hand. Even if I did make the right fold, it was obviously not. I was not happy about having to raise fold a flush.
That makes sense. I would not be happy about that either. But is what it is, is what it is. I think that's a nice hand. I guess I still don't like the turn raise, all things considered, but I like the fold, I like preflop, I like the flop. Good. So yeah, thanks for that hand. And I think that we should introduce our guest for this week. And because he's somebody you know better, or possibly just your boss now, I think you should maybe introduce him.
So today's guest is Derek Tenbush, who you might also known as Killing Bird, and he's one of the co-owners of Tournament Poker Edge. He's actually not, I know the other owner, Diego, better, but Derek is the guy who volunteered to come on the show. And I do think Derek, from what I know about him, seems like a pretty interesting guy. But he's the co-owner of Tournament Poker Edge, which is the site that I just recently started making training videos for. And he, I know, is involved in a lot of the day-to-day operations of the site. So I'm pretty curious to talk to him about both the managing of a site like that. I mean, what goes into choosing the pros, actually getting videos out of these people. I mean, I myself am pretty good about turning in the videos I'm supposed to when I'm supposed to, but from what I understand, not from anything Derek has said, but just from what I know about the industry, I think a lot of the internet superstars who are making videos are not the most diligent about meeting deadlines and that sort of thing. So I think it'll be interesting to talk about the day-to-day logistics of running a site like that, and also some of the business strategy side of things. I mean, why decide to open another poker training site 2 years ago when there were so many of them already? That sort of thing. So I'm looking forward to learning more about Derek myself.
It'll be fun to see somebody who's having some success and taking a lot of initiative in one of these little non-playing corners of poker. So let's go get him.
Our guest today is Derek Tenbush, who is the co-owner of Tournament Poker Edge, the tournament poker training site that I've recently started making videos for. And Derek is better known as Killing Bird. Where's that name come from, Derek?
That actually comes from a band that I was playing in before I ever got serious about poker, but I played in like free rolls and stuff on Poker Room. And I was like, I need a name, and I picked that. And now I regret it to this day, because when anybody Googles Killing Bird, they find the band, but if they're looking for the band, they find me, and it's completely annoying. But you know how that is; it's hard to change after 5 or 6 years of using it.
Is the band, was that something you were pretty serious about?
For a long time, yes. Although similar to poker, I was always more serious about the music business than creating music. Like, I really enjoyed that aspect of it, but I knew I was more of a business guy than a music guy. So I worked in the music business for 15 years, so I was way more serious about that than the playing. But we toured and we recorded and did all that kind of stuff. So it was a fun ride while it lasted.
How'd you get started in poker?
Actually, it's kind of, well, like I said, I did mess around a little bit on the internet playing like free rolls and stuff. But then when at some point I moved to North Carolina from Los Angeles because I was just ready to get away from that hectic lifestyle. And when I got to North Carolina, I quit my band, of course, when I moved. And when I got here, I was completely lost about what to do because I was so used to being out 3 or 4 nights a week with friends and playing or rehearsing or promoting the band or whatever. And all of a sudden I was home 7 nights a week and I was kind of going crazy. I mean, I love my family, but I felt like I needed to get out of the house at some point. and we went out to dinner and I saw a flyer for a pub league basically at a restaurant. Yeah. And I said, well, that seems like a good way to like go out, have a couple beers, just socialize, play poker. And I had, you know, I had played a little bit online. So I said, this seems like fun. So I started doing that and then, kind of did that for probably 3 or 4 months. And then eventually, finally, I guess they trusted me enough to let me know that there was a sort of back room game that you could get into once they trusted you from playing the free pub league. Right. And I transitioned into that, and that's kind of when I started playing for real money. And then I said, oh, I guess I could put money in my online account too and actually play there. So, and then like many things I get myself into, I just got way too serious about it and started trying to get better and learn and all that stuff.
Did that weird you out at all, getting invited to the backroom game? I mean, were you worried about people cheating you or robbing you or anything like that?
Not really. The stakes were still pretty small. Like, they were playing a lot of sit-and-goes and stuff, and it would kind of be like, it'd be a situation where everybody would just kind of sit down and go, so what do you guys want to play for? Yeah. And everybody would go, I don't know, $20. And everybody would just throw $20 in, and you'd pay, you know, the top two or whatever. So it was, to me, it was kind of like such a small amount of money that I didn't really care. I was just kind of like, I don't know, it's fun, and sometimes I'll win, and sometimes I'll lose. But then I did start to move on to, like, more, I guess, serious underground games, because there's no casinos in North Carolina. Well, I take that back. There's actually one in the very western part of the state. But for the longest time, they didn't have live poker. So I've never even been there once in my life. But there's a huge underground scene in the Raleigh area where I live. And I started playing in some of those games. And those, they make you a little bit nervous, but I think you kind of learn which ones are the ones you can trust and which ones are the ones you can't. And we've had our share of robberies and being busted by police and stuff like that, but I've always kind of considered it part of the rake, I guess. So I assume that any amount of money I take could end up being taken, and I just say, well, that's rake. So
likewise, medical bills if you're shot are just rake.
Yeah. Hopefully that might be the end of my underground poker days when that comes.
Yeah,
if not by my choice, by my wife's.
Is that why you wanted to get into playing online? I mean, because it felt safer, or how'd you get started online?
I think it really kind of started because I started just in my attempt to get better, I started hitting up some of the forums and stuff. So I became like a member of 2+2 and things like that, and started talking a little bit of strategy. And then I just sort of very quickly realized that if I kind of really wanted to get into that community, that I was going to I guess, need to grind online to some degree, or at least that would make it easier. And, you know, I see all these people posting hand histories and getting feedback and stuff. I'm like, well, I can't really do that. I don't have any hand histories. Okay. So I finally decided to start playing. And I never got serious about it to the point where I consider myself a pro or anything like that. You know, I had a full-time job for a long time, and I had my wife and my son. And so, you know, I'd put in like 3 or 4 nights a week playing from like 8 o'clock at night till 2 in the morning or something. But I was never like a 7-day a week grinder or anything.
So you were still working in the music industry at that time?
Yeah. Yeah. When I first got into it, I was.
What were you doing?
I did artist development, which is essentially new artist marketing. So anytime we signed a new band, it was sort of my job to take them from like 0 sales to maybe 100,000 units. And then the rest of the company took over. So I had a staff of people who worked for me around the country. And we essentially went out and marketed brand new bands.
And are you still doing that? Or is TPE a full-time thing for you now?
TPE is pretty much a full-time thing now. It's my primary source of income. Actually, right around the time that we started Tournament Poker Edge, I had left the music business, and I was looking for something else to do, and that was part of the reason why we started TPE. I continued to do a little bit of consulting in the music business, but once TPE got super busy, I just said, okay, I'm kind of... And at that time, too, the music business was really in decline, and it had kind of changed to the point where it wasn't the business that I had kind of loved for 15 years. And I just decided, this seems like a really good time to exit. And I had always, I have this weird philosophy. It's not even that weird, I guess, but some people make fun of me because it sounds like infomercial stuff or something. But I read a lot of like Gary Vaynerchuk, who is sort of a online internet marketing guru kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And he has a book called Crush It, where he talks about how if you're 1% happy with what you're doing for a living, you should quit and find something that you're 0% unhappy doing. And I think I had become maybe more than 1% unhappy in the music business. Yes. So I said, you know what? I'm just going to go find something that I'm 100% passionate about. And that was TPE. So I took that on full time, did that for about the last 2.5 years. And then actually just recently, I guess it's been about 4 or 5 months now. I'm also super into craft beer. I love home brewing, and I spend way too much money buying expensive bottles of beer. Mm-hmm. So I got an opportunity to do marketing for a local craft brewery based here in North Carolina. And it's essentially a part-time job, but it's great because I love doing it and I get free beer. So, so now that's taking up a little bit of my time as well.
Yeah.
So this gets into something I'm curious about, which is the future of Tournament Poker Edge. I mean, obviously, I think anybody who runs a business wants it to grow and grow and grow. But do you see, you know, poker being another possibly declining industry? Maybe you don't see it that way. How much growth do you think is possible for a company like TPE?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something that we talk about a lot. And one of the things we're obviously hoping for, and I'm sure anybody in the poker industry is hoping for, is sort of that second poker boom. And we feel like that will be when poker gets regulated in the United States again, which hopefully happens someday. So we're sort of working towards that. And we had always felt like that the poker world was so big that even if U.S. poker had got shut down, that it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But we were kind of surprised to see how much it impacted us when Black Friday happened. But the bright side of that is that it also means that when it does get regulated, hopefully there's huge upside. And I don't even think it just means that the people who went away from playing will come back. But I think it's, you know, multiple times more than that, because you'll have all these people who now feel like, oh, I can just deposit in a heartbeat. I can withdraw in a heartbeat. It's super safe. Nobody's stealing from me. It's all regulated. So I think that's a huge boom. I guess the real question is, how long does that last and how much bigger can it get than that boom?
Yeah. What kind of a hit did you take on Black Friday, just like percentage-wise?
Yeah, we probably lost over 50% of our customer base.
Wow.
And it took a little while. Some people, of course, pay their membership for a year or 6 months or 3 months. So we had, you know, the day Black Friday happened, we had a certain number of people, a pretty small number, contact us right away and say, oh, yeah, this whole situation is terrible. Close my account. I'm out of here. And at first we were kind of like, wow, that wasn't nearly as bad as we thought. And then memberships started running out, or as they realized they couldn't get their money off of Full Tilt, or what, you know, whatever the individual scenarios were for people, they slowly started to drop off. And yeah, we lost probably between 50 and 60% of our customers.
Wow. I think one thing a lot of people with, you know, business or entrepreneurial or even freelance ambitions wonder is, okay, I do X and I see all these companies and they all do X. How is it that I can become confident that the world actually has room for one more X, that like I can carve out a place in the marketplace? Is it like in your case, did you think, okay, there's Card Runners, there's Deuces Cracked, there's all these people, but we can do it better, but we can do something different? Like, how did you get confident enough to think that there was really room for Tournament Poker Edge?
I think we had actually done a considerable amount of research. Luckily, my business partner, his name's Diego, and we basically started the company together. He had a pretty good background in business and more in the business side than me. And I sort of had the marketing background. He had the business background, and he had done a ton of research and analysis on, you know, who the different players were. We tried to get as much information as how many members they had and things like that. And we kind of just sort of identified this hole in the market, which we felt like was tournament training. Well, it was really it was more two factors. One was tournament training, and there were some companies doing it, but nobody doing it exclusively. And then we also felt like there was a little bit of a hole for a community-based training site. So in other words, not just a place where people went and watched videos and then left the site and went home, or went on to whatever else they were doing, but where they actually went, discussed hands, met new friends, set up study groups on the side. And we felt like if we could build a community around our training site and not just put up a new video every day, that we felt like there could be a huge opportunity there. And we really didn't know how big. I mean, frankly, when we got into it, it was more of just a passion play for us. And we felt like, well, if we can make a little bit of money and maybe, you know, or break even and plus a little bit of profit, that'll be cool. And we'll get to talk with poker with all these great pros and all these great members. And that's just sort of what we were doing anyway. So we just, it's a cool opportunity. And any upside, you know, any financial upside was just kind of bonus for us.
What did you do to try to cultivate that community?
Well, I think we learned a lot from some other forums about what not to do. So we quickly tried to make sure. And a lot of it was really just talking to people and saying, look, this is not going to be forum XYZ where you post a hand that you played really badly and you get destroyed for it. Because we had members who literally were just learning what pot odds meant, or even for that matter, what the flop and turn and river meant, all the way to, you know, serious grinders. So when somebody posts a hand and goes, you know, and says, oh, I messed up on this street, it's really easy for a serious grinder to rip them to pieces. But we established very quickly and tried to get some moderators, frankly, who were going to be very good at shutting that down quickly. And I think we established so fast that it wasn't going to be tolerated, like within the first couple days of the site launching, that people just quickly felt safe. And then when they felt safe, they remember what that was like when they were a year-long member. And when somebody new came in, they were nice to them. And I mean, it sounds incredibly simple, but really, if you treat all the members with a great deal of respect, they end up treating each other with more respect. And I would bet that in the last 2 years, we've probably deleted maybe 3 posts from the forums.
Wow.
Or even edited 3 posts, which, you know, compared to a lot of poker forums out there, is probably an incredible ratio. So we've been incredibly fortunate on that front. We were also very hands-on. I think in a way it was a little bit different because Diego and I weren't professional poker players who decided to start a training site on the side. We were, you know, professional business guys who loved poker and wanted to create a cool community. So we were much more focused on the site and on the community than we were on our own poker games or, you know, our win rates or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I think we had a little bit, maybe more of a special attention to the details than some other sites do.
Has the community grown in the way that you were hoping it would? I mean, do the forums look the way you envisioned they would 2.5 years ago?
Yeah, they really have. And maybe more. it's kind of hard to have predicted what would happen, because I can remember when we got our very first customer, and I actually remember thinking to myself, you know, we turn the site on and an hour later somebody signs up, and I remember thinking to myself, what are we going to do if nobody else signs up? This guy will never. But at the time, that was a real concern. Like, what if there's only three people for the first couple of months? Like, I don't know how many people signed up for a training site. But luckily, it grew pretty quick, and it helped that we actually had some of our pros as who had small ownership shares in the company. And I think that helped encourage them to be involved in the site, including posting in the forums. And when the pros post, the members post. You know, if they see that interaction happening, they'll get way more involved. So that helped us out a lot. And, you know, thankfully, we've been able to recover pretty well from Black Friday. And now the forum is as big as it's ever been. So we're really lucky on that front.
How did you go about recovering from Black Friday? Because the site that I was working for at that time, Poker Savvy Plus, they pretty much went out of business just a couple months after. What did you do to stay profitable after you lost 60% of your members?
Yeah, a big part of it was we had to make some pretty tough decisions, and it's when I first realized that, wow, this is a real business. Up until then, it was kind of like a bunch of friends like having fun with this website and sort of growing it for the passion of growing it. And then when Black Friday happened, like, wow, now we have to make tough choices. Like, what do we do here? And you know, really the easiest part of that was saying, okay, well, we're not gonna take any money for a little while. Like, we're not gonna pay ourselves anything. So we sort of made that conscious decision. We also basically reorganized our company to a degree. Some of the pros who had those small ownership stakes in the company were Americans who either couldn't play for a while until they figured out what was happening, or just decided, I'm not moving, so I'm not playing. Okay. And so we had to make a tough decision with those guys and say, okay, well, if you can't play, then you can't really fulfill the obligations to the company. So we need to find a different way to do this. So we bought some people out, we restructured, we brought some new people in. And then probably the other really big thing we did was just a very much of an international focus. So we went out and essentially reestablished our entire marketing plan. Up until then, we, you know, many of the websites that we were advertising on and many of the magazines were US-based companies. And we decided, okay, let's go find what's the big poker forum in Brazil? What's the big poker forum in Portugal and all these different places? And we started to advertise in them. And then we signed pros from, you know, the UK and Australia and a couple more Canadians and sort of focused on, by bringing those people in, we knew, okay, well, this guy's got 1,000 Twitter followers. A bunch of them are probably Australians. So let's get them on board. And that really kind of helped to reestablish the company to a great degree. And it took some time. It probably took us, I would say, 6 to 9 months to get back to where we were pre-Black Friday. And now that about 2 months ago, we hit the point officially bigger than we were pre-Black Friday in terms of numbers of members.
Very impressive.
It was definitely a challenge, and now it's become sort of an ongoing challenge where you're constantly adjusting your marketing strategies and the way you treat the way you approach the forums and things like that. And of course, as more competitors come in, we'll have to continue to adjust.
So what does the day-to-day look like for you now?
Well, the cool thing about this is what I always say about being the marketing guy for this website is that you can literally do as much as you want, because there's no end to how much you can market. If your job is to just render the videos and post them, well, there's a distinct time when that begins and a distinct time when that ends. Marketing never stops. So I'm fortunate that I can kind of make my own schedule, and I generally do, but I love it so much that I tend to work on it pretty much all day and all night. So I'll get up at some normal hour of like 10 or 11 o'clock. And I have a sort of a checklist of things that I go down and do. So it might be, you know, that day it might be posting articles or hitting the forums and making sure that I'm responding to any questions. We have a bunch of advertising things that run. So I have to go through and monitor those, check the results from the day before, make sure that, you know, the Google ads are getting the results we need and the Facebook ads and all that kind of stuff. And then I also just spend a ton of time sort of brainstorming with other owners on different marketing ideas and things. So that might be anything from what should this next ad look like to who's the next pro we should bring in. So a lot of it is that. And then hopefully by the end of the day, I find a little bit of time to play some poker, which in a way I always think of as marketing, but is also hopefully profitable at the end.
Yeah. So you're playing now on like the Carbon Poker US facing type sites?
Yeah. Right now I'm playing primarily on Lock. And to a huge degree, I do it just to sort of try to keep my chops up. I feel like I don't want to fall so far behind that when regulation does happen that I'm one of the people that everybody's winning money from. So yeah. So I've done it pretty much to keep my chops up. I don't play nearly the stakes that I used to and things like that. But I still do it and I still enjoy it to this day. So
how does it go over with the family that you have such an open-ended job? I mean, you were saying you can kind of work on it whenever and it's never finished. I mean, surely that causes some conflict sometimes.
Yeah, I think I am lucky to some degree because I've been with my wife since I was in seventh grade when we met.
Wow.
Married in grad school. So we've been together for a very long time. And she was with me through the days where I was very serious about being a musician, which meant, you know, practicing three nights a week and maybe being out another two nights a week. And then she was with me through the music where it was always, oh, I got to go to a show in Hollywood, honey. I'll be home at three or whatever. So she's only really ever known the Derek who works, you know, huge numbers of hours. But she also works at home. So it's kind of cool because even though we're both always kind of crazy with our work schedules, we can make, it's pretty easy for us to make time. Like, you know, we really need to go out and have lunch today because we're both working way too much, or let's go see a movie tonight. So even though you end up working a lot more hours, you also have at least the flexibility to go, you know what, let's both turn it all off and just go watch a movie or whatever. And my son's 15 now, so to some degree he wants nothing to do with me. So that part's actually, and it's actually pretty cool because he's actually recently sort of started his own little internet business. So I feel like he's maybe taken a little bit of that from me, and I guess it's a good thing to have passed on a little entrepreneurial spirit, hopefully.
Yeah. What does he do?
It's actually funny. He basically does training videos, but instead of for poker, he does them for a game called Minecraft.
Oh yeah.
I've watched a couple of his videos, but it looks to be sort of like a somewhat basic game, but where you essentially build huge worlds online. And so he does these videos and he posts them on his own YouTube channel and he has his own little Twitter following and gets thousands of subscribers and it's really much.
We should definitely plug this. What's his name on YouTube? Where can the Minecraft playing listeners go check these out?
Yeah, because it's amazing how many people I talk to and they don't necessarily play, but they're always like, oh my God, my son loves Minecraft. So you can actually... Sorry, I got a little advertisement running when I was checking his YouTube account. You can find him at youtube.com/xxidol. So XXIDOL. And yeah, so I think he's got about 1,871 subscribers right now, which is, I guess, pretty impressive for a 15-year-old kid.
Yep.
Are you teaching him how to play poker too?
We actually play a ton at like family gatherings. My dad likes poker a lot too, so we'll always play like our 10 bush family Thanksgiving game and family Christmas game and stuff. And he was more into it when he was a little bit younger, but now he's kind of discovered all his own little hobbies and stuff. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of lost interest in it, but he still comes on and watches me sometimes, and you know, gives me his advice on what he thinks I should be doing, which is usually go all in.
What would you say is the most frustrating part of your job?
I think the hardest part, I don't even know if frustrating is the right word, but because that almost sounds too negative, and I don't want this to come off as being like that our members frustrate me. The challenging part is that we quickly learned that nobody likes or not everybody likes the same kind of videos. So we have people who can't stand live sweats, for example. So we have videos where people just, pros just turn on their computer, play a session and talk over it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who don't like that because they don't feel like you're getting an in-depth thought process from the pros. You know, they're onto their next hand or they're playing four tables and they can't really spend a lot of time talking about one particular table. So we're like, okay, so let's implement these things that we call, and other sites have similar versions of them, but we call them theory videos. So let's launch a theory video series where somebody can really go into depth, almost like a classroom style presentation, which actually, you know, Andrew, your first series was essentially that.
My second one is like that too.
But then there's other people who are like, oh, theory videos put me to sleep. How much longer, you know, when to three bet or sizing or whatever. And then, you know, we have a few other styles of videos and some people love them and some people hate them. And sometimes we'll get into a little bit of a streak where we're releasing, you know, 8 theory videos in a row or something. And those people who just only like live sweats will be like, oh, this is killing me. But we quickly learned that there's just nothing you can do about that other than try to put out the best possible content you can and hope that people are willing to wait a little bit longer to find the type that they like. We do have at least the benefit of being a tournament-only site, so at least they don't have to sit through, you know, 18 Heads Up Omaha videos before they finally get another tournament video. That's the one bright side. The other thing that's pretty challenging is dealing with the pros. All of our pros are super nice guys, awesome people, all that kind of stuff. But they're also poker players who, to some degree, got into poker for a reason, which is that they didn't want anybody ever telling them what to do and when to do it.
Right.
You know, most of them are not direct employees of ours, right? We can't make them record a video or make them do a series. So sometimes we, you know, what we want and what they want to do that for that week or that month don't always. So it's a little bit difficult, but, you know, 90% of them are incredibly accommodating and work really well with us. So we've kind of learned to work with that, but it certainly can be a challenge because, you know, like I said, they're used to, if they don't want to play that day, they don't. And if they don't want to work that day, they don't. So you just have to, plan for that. And we just schedule our videos so far ahead that we never run out, essentially.
Yeah. How do you deal with it if you have a guy who's been telling you for weeks, like, oh yeah, I'm going to get you a video soon. I'm going to get you a video soon. Like what tools do you have at your disposal to light a fire under his ass?
Frankly, not much. I mean, nobody's ever done it to the point where we're like, well, we just got to fire this guy. Taking way too long. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, what would be that threshold?
Yeah. Just future reference, probably like a month or so, I would say. I mean, we've certainly had people take 2 weeks to deliver something that they said they were going to deliver the next day. I would say a month is where we would start to go, geez, this guy's never going to turn in a video. But to a degree, we're sort of fortunate because we have enough pros that if somebody doesn't get their stuff in, then we just move on to the next guy and let them fill that gap for us. So yeah, it never becomes the end of the world, but obviously some of the bigger name guys are the guys that you want to get videos out from. And if they all decide to go on hiatus at the same time, it can be a little challenging.
Yeah. Is that a consideration in your hiring? I mean, are you just going after people who are big name people, or do you have a consideration of, how good of a video is this guy actually going to make? How reliable is he going to be as an employee?
I think it's both. I think the primary thing is that they be able to teach well. And one thing we do that a lot of people don't is if it's somebody, I actually don't know if we did this with you because you had done videos before. And I think I mentioned in a blog post or something that I kind of grew up watching your videos. So I already knew what you did and how you could do it. But a lot of people, we make them, even if they're a big, you know, a quote unquote big name, we make them do essentially an audition video. To make sure that they are able to teach. So that's the biggest thing. I mean, that being said, if Tom Dwan came tomorrow and said, hey, I'd like to do a video, I doubt we would make him do an audition. And even if he didn't teach well, we'd probably post a video anyway. but we also have several guys who only do like micro stakes and low stakes videos. So they're really not expected to be a known guy. Because, you know, not a lot of people railing the $1 rebuy turbo or whatever on Stars. So so for those guys, it's really all about their ability to teach. And certainly we want them to have some results as well, because, you know, how you know how it is in the poker world. People quickly go to Sharkscope or whatever and say, this guy's not even a winning player. What's he doing teaching? So those are some of the things we consider.
How do you find those? I mean, people who don't have name recognition already, I mean, are people submitting audition videos to you cold, or how do you go about finding like a guy to make micro stakes videos for you?
We do get some people who submit stuff to us, or at least email us and say, hey, can I, how do I go about trying to become a pro? But I would say 80% plus of the guys we have brought in have been referrals from other pros. So a lot of times it'll be a guy, you know, who has a buddy, sometimes they even are living together or something, and sees that he's making a little bit of money on the side making videos and gets interested that way. Or a lot of times it's just, wow, this guy's kind of on fire. We're seeing that he's winning a lot of stuff. Who knows him? And if we ask everybody we know, if anybody knows him, eventually we find somebody who does. But for the lower stakes stuff, most of that has come just through checking results, going through something like Pocket Fives and seeing who's shipping tournaments recently. Or if particularly in America, you start to learn pretty quickly who the sort of low stakes grinders are, because if you're playing and you see a certain person at your table every single day, you go, wow, this guy plays a lot. Let's check his stats. And if he's good, might be somebody you consider. And in one case, we actually took a member and promoted him to being a instructor for the site. He's one of our early members. Riverman123 is his name online. And the guy just grinded so hard. He grinds 6-7 days a week, and he was just winning tournaments over and over again. And members were always asking him questions like, why'd you do that? Or what, you know, why'd you here or raise there? And finally we said, maybe we should just pay this guy to make vids for us.
I'm actually surprised that's only happened once. I mean, given that you've talked about the site being so community focused and community driven, I would think there would have been more people since, you know, 2.5 years ago who would have emerged as like community leaders in on the forums.
Yeah, well, I think part of it is that the guys who kind of became those leaders or started to win so many tournaments, eventually sort of they move on. Not so much move on away from the site, but they just stop posting as much and stuff because then they've started money and they're grinding a lot harder. And they'll still post occasionally, but they're just not as active as they used to be. Mm. And we have approached a few other people, and sometimes people just aren't interested, either because they don't have time or the money's not as necessary anymore. So it's kind of it's a little bit of a catch 22 because the best players are going to be the ones who probably don't need the money. So you really have to find somebody who either sees that as free income and is willing to take it, or likes coaching and teaching so much that they're willing to do it just for the sake of that.
Mm. What do you have planned for the future, if there's not too much to give away?
No, that's cool. I think one of the things we're definitely going to do is add more pros. And in particular, I think we'll continue to look for international pros. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a big focus for us going forward. Additionally, we will hopefully continue to grow our international focus. We've actually started to look into getting some people to do some translations for us.
I was about to ask if you had any plans to do non-English language videos.
Yeah, it's definitely something we want to do. And we've actually looking at it. We actually initially looked at it pre-Black Friday. And then when everything went down with that, we essentially put it on the back burner because it's very work intensive, but it's also more expensive than you would. So we kind of put it on the back burner, but we've sort of started to revisit it again. It's an interesting dilemma. Like, do we take the existing videos and have them translated, or do we just go out and get some people who speak Portuguese and have them make videos? But then what do all the people who speak English do when that video comes out that day? Do we have to translate that to English? So breaking into the international markets is sort of just challenging that way from just sort of a logistics standpoint, not just a matter of finding these guys, but figuring out how you fit them into the schedule and how you get their videos translated and all those kind of things. Mm. But I do think that will be a focus one way or another.
It seems like kind of an underlying assumption that most members are watching most of the videos. Like it matters to a guy that the video that comes out on a certain day isn't the kind of video that he likes, which is never really the way that I've used poker sites. Like I usually just join a site for one or two certain players or one or two types of games, and I watch their videos when they came out, but it didn't really matter to me that much what other videos were out there. Is that the case, that you have like a lot of your members are watching most of the videos that you produce?
Yeah, a lot of them do. I would say, it varies, of course, but I would say that at least half of our members watch every video.
Wow.
And those numbers, so we get statistics on how many times our videos have been viewed. Now, it's possible that some people are going back and watching them twice. It's possible that somebody watches it halfway through, then quits, and then comes back and finishes it, and maybe that counts as two. So those numbers could be a little bit skewed by those kind of factors. But I'm kind of like you. Like, so when I was talking about this idea of how some people just hate a certain kind of video or love a certain kind more than another, I was always like that too. Any poker site I was a member of, if it was just a player that I never seemed to get much from, I would just skip their video and come back in 3 or 4 days and find a new one. But now, we usually put our videos up at like 1 or 2 in the morning. And sometimes if it's like 4 in the morning, we'll start to get emails saying, where's today's video? What happened today? Which I guess is a great thing. It's a good problem to have that people are that anxious for stuff to be rolled out.
It seems like that's the kind of site you wanted, where people were really invested in it as a community, or trying to be aware of everything that's going on and not just watching isolated videos.
That's the case, even if it does make our life a little more challenging. Say the other thing that we really want to focus on going forward is, and it's kind of, I guess, twofold. One is just sort of improving the functionality of the site, but along with that, improving how we present material. So coming up with new teaching methods, essentially, and whether that's just a different way of doing videos or if it's something above and beyond videos altogether, we're not really sure yet. When we got in, we felt like there was a little hole in the training market. I don't know if there's too many holes left in the training market for, if somebody knew where to try to start up at this point. But I do feel like there's an opportunity for the existing training sites to improve how they present material and how they teach people, essentially. So, that's something we're constantly thinking about and sort of brainstorming on how we can make our players better more effectively, I guess.
Yeah, well, include me in those discussions. That's something I'm pretty interested in myself.
That would be great. Love to get your feedback on that.
So I don't want to ask for any company secrets or anything, but how much do you guys worry about intellectual property issues? Is it a case where you just try to protect your content and figure that not that many people are going to be stealing it who would have signed up, and so you don't worry about it anymore? Or do you actually have to go out and check torrent sites and things like that? And do you really have to do a lot to protect your intellectual property like that?
Yeah, we do. We worried about it more early on. And it was interesting because having come from the music business that had sort of recently been destroyed by people stealing, copyrighted material, it was something that everybody was very worried about. But I also had this unique perspective of seeing the music business, I think, react the wrong way to that challenge. So we sort of quickly decided that's going to be just part of doing business. Even if you can put the best DRM technology on these videos, people can find a way. It's not difficult at all to steal a video, even with some sort of protection on it. And we quickly realized that. So obviously we have protection on ours to the point that you have to be a member to view it, things like that. And when we see things pop up on torrent sites, we do contact them and say, hey, we would appreciate if you would take that down. But we've never gone as far as hiring lawyers or suing or
lobbying Congress to change laws and things like that.
What we decided was, okay, this part of it's going to happen. People are going to some degree steal our videos. So let's make our site so much more valuable than just the videos that they want to come join just for that. So they can go to a torrent site, download every video, cool. But then let's make them go, man, I wish I could go discuss this on the forums, or I wish I could also read that person's feedback about the videos. So that really became our goal. We just said, let's make the rest of the site so valuable that people still want to be a member, even if they could get the videos for free.
How effective has that been? I mean, do you have any idea like how often your stuff is getting stolen?
Not really, to be honest. I mean, we see it pop up on torrent sites and stuff all the time. Actually, no, I shouldn't even say all the time because it's actually not all that frequently. But we don't know how many people are downloading them from those sites or anything.
Yeah.
The only thing we really have any way to control is people sharing their Tournament Poker Edge account with friends. And that's probably the thing that happens the most often is we'll get a notice that'll say, oh, this person has logged into their account from 17 different IP addresses in different countries.
Yeah.
Okay. Either a serious world traveler or he's sharing his account and we'll just quickly contact that person. And it's amazing how quickly the sharing stops. I'm always really impressed and I guess a little bit proud that our members go, oh, I probably shouldn't have been doing that. And they quickly go back to logging in from one or two IP addresses.
Yeah. What kind of response do you get from the torrent sites when you ask them to take stuff down?
I would say 9 out of 10 times we get no response, which isn't surprising at all.
Right.
If I ran a torrent site, I wouldn't respond either. but amazingly, every once in a while, and maybe it's just because maybe other companies do more than we do, but amazingly, every once in a while, when we contact them, they go, oh, sorry about that, and then they all disappear from their site. And that's really the only reason that we still contact them, for the hopes that every once in a while they'll take it down. I assume that they just have so much content that it's not worth them taking the risk of having to fight anybody on it.
Yeah.
So they just kind of take the way out. So that's kind of what we always hope for.
Is there anything that's been surprising to you that hasn't evolved at all the way you were expecting it to when you started the site?
That's a really good question. I guess, well, I think the thing that I think has surprised me the most, and like you said, it did not evolve the way I expected, but in a good way, has been the success of our podcasts. And I guess maybe you guys can sort of relate to this, obviously, because
we were a little surprised by ours too.
It's pretty cool to watch. I'm sure you guys get as much of a kick out of it as I do. Like when we started it, we were just kind of like, well, this will be kind of a neat little thing to do. And we'll put one out every once in a while. And it sort of quickly became, first of all, the number one marketing tool that we had. It's amazing how many people say, oh, I listened to your podcast for a year and finally I finally got around to signing up. But even more so than the videos, if we go too long without doing a podcast, we hear about it really, really quickly. And people love it. And it's amazing how, like, for me, being one of the hosts, when I sit down at a table on Lock and have two people at my table go, oh, are you the Killing Bird? And I'm like, wow, I never thought I would be referred to as the Killing Bird. I love your podcast. I listen to it all the time. That was probably the most surprising thing. And I was always a little bit of a podcast geek. Like I that's all I listen to on my iPhone is podcasts. And so I always knew that I want one, but I guess I didn't realize how many other people were digging into them. And that was really cool to see.
Do you have any speculations about the future of podcasts? Do you think it's still growing? Do you think that, I mean, I've made $0 from this podcast and I'm just fine with that, but do you think that it's something that there's money in? Do you think it's something that's going to grow?
Listen to several podcasts about podcasting, which I guess really shows what a dork I am. And they talk a lot about the growth of podcasting. And I think there's a couple of things that clearly show how much bigger it's going to get. One of the biggest things is that now when you get an iPhone, there's actually a podcasting app on the iPhone. So when you think about the sheer number of people who are instantly being exposed to the world of podcasting just by having that button on their phone, that's a pretty huge deal in the big picture. And I think that you'll see more and more numbers start to creep in as more and more people, A, buy a smartphone, and B, realize that podcasting exists. And I do think that eventually there'll become more and more ways to monetize podcasting. It's not like, like you said, I'm also perfectly fine that we don't make money off of our podcast. I mean, I guess we do indirectly as a marketing tool, but we don't charge anybody to listen to our podcast directly. And that's fine with me, but I think you'll see other companies start to realize that there's huge value in podcasting and start to want to advertise on them and become, you know, the presented by company for different podcasts. I definitely think that there's an opportunity to, for podcasts to start making money via, whether it's advertising or the one thing I don't think anybody is ever really going to be able to do. And some have tried is to sell their podcast. I just don't think it's going to work. I don't think people are going to pay because they're just so used to it being a free medium.
And there's so much good free stuff out there.
Yeah. Which is amazing. I wouldn't want it any other way. I'd rather make no money from my podcast and have free access to the millions of podcasts that I have access to.
Yeah.
The other way around. So
I feel like we're living in a golden age. I mean, people complain about some of these features and it's like, oh, you know, the internet is just the sea of crap or whatever. But I mean, it's amazing. It's a wonderful time to be alive. I can go grocery shopping and listen to Mark Maron and then the Tournament Poker Edge podcast. And it's just, it's absolutely stunning to me what cultural riches we have these days. So I agree with you there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I find the whole world of podcasting and internet marketing in general as being incredibly fascinating. Like I could, you know, we're talking about my son's YouTube page. I could sit and watch him do that for hours because I just find it amazing that there's people out there who want to watch those videos and want to converse with him on Twitter and things like that. Like, I think it's amazingly fascinating. It kind of reminds me of when everybody was kind of complaining about people posting about politics on Facebook during the election. And I always just kept thinking in my head, wow, what if everybody in Egypt hated that talking about politics on social media?
Yeah.
Would be a really different place if nobody complained.
Yeah.
What are the podcasts that you guys have? You've got the one that you and Diego host, Diphthong's got a show. Are there others?
Yeah, there's basically three. Like I said, there's the Tournament Poker Edge podcast, which is essentially a tournament strategy podcast almost exclusively.
That's the one that you and Diego host, and then your guests are usually just the pros who work for the site, or do you have other guests as well?
Usually pros from the site. We've ventured out occasionally to other people, but not very often, because those people are A, easily accessible to us, and we do hope that people will listen to these guys talk and go, wow, I'd love to learn more from him, so I'm going to sign up for the site. Obviously, there is that marketing element to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
We have another podcast called Tournament Poker Edge Live, which is sort of a sporadic podcast. We do it pretty regularly during the World Series in Vegas, and it's really informal and basically us sitting down at the end of the day going, so how was the WSOP 1K today? How'd you bust out? Were there any interesting hands? Sometimes they're 15 minutes long, sometimes they're 45 minutes long, and sometimes we go 6 months without doing one. So that was pretty sporadic. And then the newest one, which I actually think is one of the most interesting, is it's called the Chirp Herm Show, and it's, as you said, hosted by Mark Herm, who goes online as Diphthong. And essentially, he's a recovering substance abuser and an amazing poker player. And so podcast is essentially him talking about a little bit about poker, a little bit about life, and a little bit about doing all of that while recovering from drug and alcohol abuse. And he brings in other poker players to talk about all of those different topics. And I find it super interesting. It reminds me a little bit of the Thinking Poker podcast in that it is a poker podcast, and it is a lot of times talking to poker players or poker professionals, but it's not really your standard poker podcast with all the typical questions that are asked of poker players. And I think it's really, really interesting to listen to. So hopefully people will check it out and like it. You have to get through Diphthong's weird lingo and strange words that he throws out. If you can survive that, then there's some really good nuggets in there.
What do you recommend for people who are either thinking about joining TPE or have recently joined? Where's the best place to get started now that you have so many videos and there's this whole community going on? How can a new person insert themselves into that community?
Well, I think the first thing I think that's worth doing, well, two things. First, start checking out the podcast because it'll give you a really good glimpse into the personality of the site. I think it's pretty representative of kind of how we engage with our community in general. But there's also on our website, there are a number of free videos that people can check out. So if they're not really familiar with training videos in general, which, you know, a lot of people are not, they can go there and kind of get a feel. And we have a little bit of everything up there in terms of live sweats and theory videos and hand history reviews and stuff like that. So people can check those videos out and just kind of see if this is the kind of learning they're looking for. Because I do think some people at the end of the day are either, you know, they might be better off getting a personal coach. They might be better with books, you know, just different people learn different ways. So check out the videos, see if it's the kind of thing that you're interested in. And then if you do decide to join up, instantly go to the forums and we have an introduce yourself thread and say hi, because that's probably the quickest way that to sort of alert other people that you're there. And then start posting, you know, find some hands from recent hand histories, get them in there, let people start giving you feedback, give some other people feedback. And because you'll find that it's very reciprocal. If you give your thoughts on some hands, you'll tend to get more thoughts on your hands. So I think that's a pretty good way to sort of insert yourself into the community once you've become a member.
Nate, anything else you wanted to bug Derek about?
No, that was great. Thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate your candidness.
I enjoyed it, guys. And like I said, I'm a big fan of the podcast. So keep doing what you guys are doing.
Thanks again to Derek and to everyone out there listening. Please keep the emails coming to podcast@thinkingpoker.net and have a great week.